Welcome to Savatri, session number 3. A heart of silence in the hands of joy. Let's begin with a meditation. John Robert, could you mute? In lieu of having a meditation bell, we'll let that be the meditation bell. We lost Marco Mossi in the meantime. I was thinking of beginning by talking a little bit about the narrative arc, but that was, I'd like to check in with the group and maybe Marco Morelli, since John Robert and Andrea and I have a lot of experience with the narrative arc. And then I was thinking a couple of things too logistically. I was thinking of having a pass through the entire canto and then going back to the beginning and doing a page reading and then discussing that page and then a page reading and discussing the next page. It's a short canto. And like last time, I put out a suggestion and somebody suggested something else and we went with that. So I don't remember the details, but I'm super open to how we want to proceed. But I would like to check in with Marco Morelli to see how he's doing with it and maybe get some feedback from him first on how you want to proceed, Marco.
It would be helpful to me to have a brief overview of the narrative arc, at least of this section, this canto that we're reading. And then to follow your suggestion of reading it through would be good. And then to go back and do a closer read or closer sounding out maybe of the section of the pages. That sounds good to me.
So my thought, I'm looking through the chapter, and there is a break about halfway. So maybe two of us, you know, we can have two readers, the first pass through, whatever. It seems a lot for one person to read the whole thing. That's my feeling.
I wasn't suggesting one person read the whole thing. Establish, read one page, but then have all pass through the whole thing, and then go back and do a page by page.
Oh.
How's that, Andrea? A little different.
Oh, I did. I guess I misunderstood. So you are suggesting we start, one person starts reading till...
Do what we've been doing, a page by page reading in circle, but read it completely and then go back through for another pass, but stopping at each page to discuss how we're understanding it, what's jumping out.
Gotcha.
Good. And John Robert?
That's okay with me.
Great. I invite John Robert and Andrea to jump into the narrative arc discussion. I'd like to start actually with the table of contents under book 7, the book of yoga. So if we recall, book 1, canto 1, the second section started and Savitri 2 awoke among these tribes. That is on the day. And then the last line is something like, this was the day when Satyavan must die. So why we're looking at book 7 is because on this day that Satyavan must die is after the entire book of yoga. So the book of, and pardon me, let's back up a couple more cantos, three more books. Let's back up three more books. So go to book 4 in the table of contents, just to have a look. This is Savitri's birth. Canto 1, the birth and childhood of the flame. That's the birth and childhood of Savitri. She grows up, the growth of the flame. In brief, she meets no suitors in her realms, and she goes out on a quest to find her suitor. So that's book 4. Then book 5 is the book of love, the destined meeting place. She meets Satyavan. Canto 3, they have a talk, and they're completely in love, and they get married by the sun. It's quite beautiful. So then she goes back to the palace in Madra, the book of fate. In comes the characters Narad, who is an oracle, and Ashwapati, and the queen, and he sees right away.
She goes back to the palace, meaning the palace of her father, where she grew up.
Thank you, John Robert. Yeah, and Narad takes a look at her and says that the fate is that Satyavan will die in a year. And that entire book, the book of fate, the word of fate, the way of fate and the problem of the pain, and the problem of pain, that's 1 year before Satyavan must die. So the book of yoga is her realizing that. She's in circuitry with death and with Satyavan. She knows that this is coming. And book 1, the book of yoga, is the joy of union with Satyavan, and the foreknowledge of death and the heart's grief and pain.
Canto 1, Mateo, just to be clear. No, it's not book 1, it's canto 1.
Thank you. As my mind, my mouth and my mind sometimes are connected. So canto 2, the parable for the search for the soul, the parable of the search for the soul. Her yoga is beginning in that search. She enters into the inner countries. The triple soul forces are not false souls, but they're all the different things that we call soul, the vital soul, the mental soul, all these different forms of soul forces that exist. And she comes in contact with going down further and actually finding her soul. And from there, she reaches nirvana. She reaches the absolute. and then discovers the cosmic spirit and cosmic consciousness. And that's where we are in Canto, in Book One, Canto Two, right after her whole year of yoga. On the day that Satyavan must die, we encounter this Canto, that's Canto Two, the issue. And I'll let that unfold. There's a life review in it. There's the culmination of her entire yoga is in Book One, Canto Two, the issue. So I wanted to place it in there. And then when we move on to Book Three next time, Canto Three of Book One next time, it's the Yoga of the King, and it starts out, a world's desire compelled her mortal birth. And there's a her that appears in that first sentence twice. And then that's the end of Savitri. We've gone back 18 years in the story to bring us up to the birth of Savitri, where we started in this, where we started looking at the table of contents. Anyway, that's a summary, Andrea.
Yeah, so one thing that is fascinating in here is she's not just going back and reviewing her own life, her current life, but she's reviewing her all of her lifetimes. They all come through in her consciousness. So she becomes aware of the whole thing. This description of that's right there on the first page. It's just really wonderful.
So, Mateo, to make sure I understand the temporality, you brought us into Book 7, the Book of Yoga, up to Canto 7 in Book 7, the discovery of the cosmic spirit and the cosmic consciousness. And then from there, we would go back to Canto 1 of Book 1, which is the
Part 2, the second section of Canto 1, Book 1. And Savitri 2.
Canto 2.
Canto 1. Book 1, Canto 1, Section 2. And Savitri 2 awoke among these tribes. She's awakened. She's waking up on the day. She's getting out of bed. Not just waking up not just waking up metaphorically. She's waking up on that day that Satyavan must die.
Okay.
Yeah. And we'll see that in the Book of Death also, when she wakes back up and talks to the queen talks to Satyavan's mother. Now she's not in her palace. She's in the forest hermitage of this fallen king, Satyavan's father. And she's waking up, and she's never gone to work with Satyavan. By going to work, meaning going out into the forest to chop wood and be with the animals, be with the plants. So on this day, she wakes up. She talks with the queen, which is the first, she's barely mentioned, Satyavan's mother, and then she goes out into the forest with him, and he dies. Okay. And then the rest is her process in circuitry with dead, corporeal dead Satyavan and death, and that's the turning point there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How about we're ready to begin? How about Marco, Andrea, John Robert, and then Mateo? Does that sound like a good? All you have to remember is the person that you follow.
And will I be reading one page?
Yeah, until the closest period.
Okay, I'll read to the colon at the end of this first page.
There's a period at the top of the next page, isn't there?
Oh, good. Perfect.
Yeah. Savitri, yeah.
Canto 2, The Issue. A while withdrawn in secret fields of thought, her mind moved in a many-imaged past that lived again and saw its end approach. Dying, it lived imperishably in her. Transient and vanishing from transient eyes, invisible, a fateful ghost of self, it bore the future on its phantom breast. Along the fleeting event's far backward trail, regressed the stream of the insistent hours. And on the bank of the mysterious flood, peopled with well-loved forms, now seen no more, and the subtle images of things that were, her witness spirit stood reviewing time. All that she once had hoped and dreamed and been, flew past her eagle-winged through memory's skies. I'll read that again. All that she once had hoped and dreamed and been, flew past her eagle-winged through memory's skies. As in a many-hued flaming inner dawn, her life's broad highways and its sweet bypaths lay mapped to her sun-clear recording view. From the bright country of her childhood's days, and the blue mountains of her soaring youth, and the paradise groves and peacock wings of love to joy clutched under the silent shadow of doom in a last turn where heaven raced with hell. 12 passionate months led in a day of fate. An absolute supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes when he draws near to God. An hour arrives when fail all nature's means, forced out from the protecting ignorance and flung back on his naked primal need, he at length must cast from him his surface soul and be the unbarged entity within. That hour had fallen now on Savitri.
I'd just like to reread that. And be the ungarbed entity within. That hour had now fallen now on Savitri. A point she had reached where life must be in vain, or in her unborn element awake, her will must cancel her body's destiny. For only the unborn spirit's timeless power can lift the yoke imposed by birth in time. For only the unborn spirit's timeless power can lift the yoke imposed by birth in time. Only the self that builds this figure of self can race the fixed interminable line that joins these changing names, these numberless lives, these new oblivious personalities, and keeps still lurking in our conscious acts the trail of old forgotten thoughts and deeds. Disown the legacy of our buried selves, the burdensome heirship to our vanished forms, accepted blindly by the body and soul. An episode in an unremembered tale, its beginning lost, its motive and plot concealed. A once living story has prepared and made our present fate, child of past energies. The fixity of the cosmic sequences, fastened with hidden inevitable links, she must disrupt, dislodge by her soul's force, her past, a block on the immortal's road. Make a raised ground and shape anew her fate. A colloquy of the original gods, meeting upon the borders of the unknown, her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous, dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause against the universe, we its single self. On the bare peak where self is alone with naught, and life has no sense and love no place to stand, she must plead her case upon extinction's verge. In the world's death cave, uphold life's helpless claim and vindicate her right to be and love. Altered must be nature's harsh economy. Acquittance she must win from her past bond. An old account of suffering exhaust. Strike out from time the soul's long compound debt and the heavy servitudes of the karmic gods, the slow revenge of unforgiving law, and the deep need of universal pain and hard sacrifice and tragic consequence.
Out of a timeless barrier she must break, penetrate with her thinking depths the void's monstrous hush. Look into the lonely eyes of immortal death, and with her nude spirit measure the infinite's night. The great and dolorous moment now was close. A mailed battalion marching to its doom, the last long days went by with heavy tramp, long, but too soon to pass, too near the end. Alone amid the many faces loved, aware among unknowing happy hearts, her armored spirit kept watch upon the hours, listening for a foreseen tremendous step in the closed beauty of the inhuman wilds. A combatant in silent and dreadful lists, the world unknowing, for the world she stood. No helper had she save the strength within. There was no witness of terrestrial eyes. The gods above and nature's soul below were the spectators of that mighty strife. Around her were the austere sky-pointing hills and the green, murmurous, broad, deep-thoughted woods muttered incessantly their muffled spell. A dense, magnificent, colored, self-wrapped life draped in the leaves, vivid emerald monotone, and set with checkered sunbeams and blithe flowers, immured her destiny's secluded seam. There had she grown to the stature of her spirit. The genius of titanic silences, steeping her soul in its wide loneliness, had shown to her herself's bare reality and mated her with her.
Its solitude greatened her human hours with a background of the eternal and unique, a force of spare, direct necessity, reduced the heavy framework of man's days and his overburdening mass of outward needs to a first thin strip of simple animal wants. And the mighty wildness of the primitive earth and the brooding magnitude of patient trees and the musing sapphire leisure of the sky and the solemn weight of the slowly passing months had left in her deep room for thought and God. There was her drama's radiant prologue lived, a spot for the Eternals, a spot for the Eternals' tread on earth, set in the cloistral yearning of the woods, and watched by the aspiration of the peaks, appeared through an aureate opening in time, where stillness listening felt the unspoken word, and the hours forgot to pass towards grief and change. Here, with the suddenness divine advents have, repeating the marvel of the first descent, changing to rapture the dull earthly round, love came to her hiding the shadow. Love came to her hiding the shadow, death. Well might he find in her his perfect shrine. Since first the earth being's heavenward growth began, through all the long ordeal of the race, never a rarer creature bore his shaft. That burning test of the Godhead in our parts, a lightning from the heights on our abyss, all in her pointed to a nobler kind. Near to earth's wideness, intimate with heaven, exalted and swift, her young, large-visioned spirit voyaging through worlds of splendor and of calm, overflew the waves of thought to unborn things.
Ardent was her self-poised, unstumbling will, her mind a sea of white sincerity, passionate in flow, had not one turbid wave. As in a mystic and dynamic dance, a priestess of immaculate ecstasies, inspired and ruled from truth's revealing vault, moves in some prophet cavern of the gods, a heart of silence in the hands of joy, inhabited with rich creative beats, a body like a parable of dawn that seemed a niche for veiled divinity, or golden temple door to things beyond. Immortal rhythms swayed in her time-born steps. Her look, her smile awoke celestial sense, even in earth stuff, and their intense delight poured a supernal beauty on men's lives. A wide self-giving was her native act, a magnanimity as of sea or sky, enveloped with its greatness all that came and gave a sense as of a greatened world. Her kindly care was a sweet temperate sun, her high passion a blue heaven's equipoise, as might a soul fly like a hunted bird, escaping with tired wings from a world of storms, and a quiet reach like a remembered breast, in a haven of safety and splendid soft repose. One could drink life back in streams of honey fire, recover the lost habit of happiness, feel her bright nature's glorious ambience, and preen joy in her warmth and colors rule. A deep of compassion, a hushed sanctuary, her inward help unbarred a gate in heaven. Love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. The great unsatisfied Godhead here could dwell, vacant of the dwarf self's imprisoned air. Her mood could harbor his sublimer breath, spiritual that can make all things divine. Her mood could harbor his sublimer breath, spiritual that can make all things divine.
For even her gulfs were secrecies of light. At once she was the stillness and the word, a continent of self-diffusing peace, an ocean of untrembling virgin fire. The strength, the silence of the gods were hers. In her he found a vastness like his own. His high, warm, subtle ether he refound and moved in her as in his natural home. In her he met his own eternity. Till then, no mournful line had barred this ray. On the frail breast of this precarious earth, since her orbed sight in its breath-fastened house, opening in sympathy with happier stars, where life is not exposed to sorrowful exchange, for to sorrowful change, remembered beauty death-claimed lids ignore, and wondered at this world of fragile forms, carried on canvas strips of shimmering time. The impunity of unborn mites was hers. Although she leaned to bear the human load, her walk kept still the measures of the gods. Earth's breath had failed to stain that brilliant glass. Unsmeared with the dust of our mortal atmosphere, it still reflected heaven's spiritual joy. Almost they saw who lived within her light, her playmate in the sempiternal spheres, descended from its unattainable realms. In her attracting advent's luminous wake, the white fire dragon bird of endless bliss, drifting with burning wings above her days. Heaven's tranquil shield guarded the mission child. A glowing orbit was her early term. Years like golden raiment of the gods that pass. Her youth sat throned in calm felicity. But joy cannot endure until the end. There is a darkness in terrestrial things that will not suffer long. Too glad a note. John Robert?
Am I starting on her too? Can you all hear me?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Okay. On her too closed the inescapable hand. The armed immortal bore the snare of time. One dealt with her who meets the burdened great. A signer of the ordeal and the path, who chooses in this holocaust of the soul, death, fall, and sorrow as the spirit's goads the dubious godhead with his torch of pain, lit up the chasm of the unfinished world and called her to fill with her vast self the abyss. August and pitiless in his calm outlook, heightening the eternal's dreadful strategy, he measured the difficulty with the might and dug more deep the gulf that all must cross. Assailing her divinest elements, he made her heart kin to the striving human heart and forced her strength to its appointed road. For this she had accepted mortal breath, to wrestle with the shadow she had come and must confront the riddle of man's birth and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night. Whether to bear with ignorance and death or hew the ways of immortality, to win or lose the godlike game for man was her soul's issue, thrown with destiny's dice. But not to submit and suffer was she born. To lead, to deliver was her glorious part. Here was no fabric of terrestrial make, fit for a day's use by busy, careless powers. An image fluttering on the screen of fate, half animated for a passing show, or a castaway on the ocean of desire, flung to the eddies in a ruthless sport and tossed along the gulfs of circumstance. A creature born to bend beneath the yoke, a chattel and a plaything of time's lords, or one more pawn who comes destined to be pushed one slow move forward on a measureless board in the chess play of the earth's soul with doom. Such is the human figure drawn by time.
A conscious frame was here, a self-born force. In this enigma of the dusk of God, this slow and strange, uneasy compromise of limiting nature with a limitless soul, where all must move between an ordered chance and an uncaring blind necessity. Too high the fire spiritual dare not blaze. If once it met the intense original flame, an answering touch might shatter all measures made and earth sink down with the weight of the infinite. A jail is this immense material world. Across each road stands armed a stone-eyed law. At every gate, the huge dim sentinels pace. A gray tribunal of the ignorance, an inquisition of the priests of night, in judgment sit on the adventurer's soul. And the dual tables and the karmic norm Restrain the Titan in us and the God. Pain with its lash, joy with its silver bribe, guard the wheel's circling immobility. A bond is put on the high-climbing mind, a seal on the too large, wide-open heart. Death stays the journeying discoverer life. Thus is the throne of the inconscient safe, while the tardy coilings of the eons pass, and the animal browses in the sacred fence, and the gold hawk can cross the skies no more. But one stood up and lit the limitless flame, arraigned by the dark power that hates all bliss, in the dire court where life must pay for joy, sentenced by the mechanic justicer to the afflicting penalty of man's hopes. Her head she bowed not to the stark decree, barring her helpless heart to destiny's stroke.
So bows, and must the mind-born will in man, obedient to the statutes fixed of old, admitting without appeal the nether gods. In her the superhuman cast its seed, inapt to fold its mighty wings of dream, her spirit refused to hug the common soil. Or, finding all life's golden meanings robbed, compound with earth, struck from the starry list, or quench with black despair the God-given light. I'm going to read that one more time, that whole sentence. Inapt to fold its mighty wings of dream, her spirit refused to hug the common soil, or, finding all life's golden meanings robbed, compound with earth, struck from the starry list, or quench with black despair the God-given light. Accustomed to the eternal and the true, her being conscious of its divine founts, asked not from mortal frailty pain's relief, patched not with failure, bargain, or compromise. A work she had to do, a word to speak. Writing the unfinished story of her soul in thoughts and actions graved in nature's book, she accepted not to close the luminous page, cancel her commerce with eternity, or set a signature of weak assent to the brute balance of the world's exchange. A force in her that toiled since earth was made, accomplishing in life the great world plan, pursuing after death immortal aims, repugned to admit frustration's barren role, forfeit the meaning of her birth in time, obey the government of the casual fact, or yield her high destiny up to passing chance. In her own self, she found her high recourse. She matched with the iron law her sovereign right. Her single will opposed the cosmic rule. To stay the wheels of doom, this greatness rose. At the unseen's knock upon her hidden gates, her strength made greater by the lightning's touch, awoke from slumber in her heart's recess.
It bore the stroke of that which kills and saves. Across the awful march no eye can see, barring its dreadful route no will can change, she faced the engines of the universe. A heart stood in the way of the driving wheels. Its giant workings paused in front of a mind. Its stark conventions met the flame of a soul. A magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled ineffable's timeless will. A prayer, a master act, a king idea can link man's strength to a transcendent force. Then miracle is made the common rule. One mighty deed can change the course of things. A lonely thought becomes omnipotent. All now seems nature's massed machinery, an endless servitude to material rule and long determination's rigid chain, her firm and changeless habits aping law, her empire of unconscious deft device, annul the claim of man's free human will. He too is a machine amid machines. A piston brain pumps out the shapes of thought. A beating heart cuts out emotion's modes. An insentient energy fabricates a soul. Or the figure of the world reveals the signs of a tied chance, repeating her old steps in circles around matter's binding posts. A random series of inept events, to which reason lends elusive sense, is here, or the empiric life's instinctive search, or a vast ignorant mind's colossal work. But wisdom comes, and vision grows within. Then nature's instrument crowns himself her king. He feels his witnessing self and conscious power. His soul steps back and sees the light supreme. Shall I just continue to the end?
Okay. Sure.
A Godhead stands behind the brute machine. This truth broke in a triumph of fire. A victory was won for God in man. The deity revealed its hidden face. The great world mother now in her arose. A living choice reversed fate's cold death turn. Affirmed the spirit's tread on circumstance, pressed back the senseless, dire revolving wheel, and stopped the mute march of necessity. A flaming warrior from the eternal peaks, empowered to force the door denied and closed, smote from death's visage its dumb absolute, and burst the bounds of consciousness and time. End of Canto 2.
Anybody wants to discuss, but if no one has anything to say, John, or when we're ready, John Robert, could you start on just a page for the Canto 1, the issue? And we'll go through it page by page, unless anyone has anything burning to share right now.
Well, I wouldn't mind taking a view on the whole in the way before going bit by bit, page by page. Am I correct in understanding that there's something of, in this issue, Canto, a question of resolution, a question of the freedom of the will coming into a encounter with this blind brute force of the inconscient, of the cosmic law, or the seeming absoluteness of death, of this way in which one thing happens after the other. Kind of like Winston Churchill said about history being one damn thing after the other. And it seems to me that there is here a kind of crisis of the will, in a sense, of coming to assert itself in the face of that seemingly overwhelming reality. Would that be a fair first reading of, or understanding of, the text?
Yeah, I think that's a really good reading of it. Sherbino's heightening the stuff we kind of take for granted in our servitude to the natural law, and he's showing how, first of all, how it is a slavery, it's a servitude, it seems like a machine from the outside, and it's contrasting that with this being whose whole purpose, whose whole life purpose is to question that and to challenge it.
Thank you. That's helpful.
So I'd like to add to that. So even though we can apply this, of course, to ourselves, but she came to make this possible. This is her issue. This is the Divine Mother's incarnation's issue. Savitri, in this case, the mother in our contemporary time, where she came to conquer death for us. Oh, hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Jeffrey. Let's see.
We don't hear you, though I see your lips moving.
And you're unmuted, so maybe something else. You can hear us, Jeffrey.
Okay. Can you say something so we can hear you?
Yeah, hello. No?
Ah, hello there.
Sorry, I got the time mixed up. I thought it was two. Not one.
So Jeffrey, we've just had a complete pass through the canto. We're discussing it more globally, and then we're going to do a page-by-page reading through it.
Okay.
You're just in time. Yeah, Andrea go ahead, Marco.
Oh, well, this will be out of context for Jeffrey, but I would like to ask how you understand or see the relationship between the Divine Mother and the self. If that question makes sense.
I think when the veils are rent, they're one and the same. But when the veils are rent.
That's a big question. That's our journey.
Okay.
To learn to embody her, you know, to surrender the self to the Divine Mother and let her work through us. That is how I see that.
Thank you.
I'd like to say, backing up a little bit, it's interesting that you picked out the will, Marco. It's synonymous with Agni, it's synonymous with fire, and she gets called the flame over and over again. It represents the physical. There's also higher wills and things like that. So when John Robert and I recently had a pass through it, it was the mind that was jumping out at me all throughout the canto. And there's also life jumping out. So I'm wondering also, is it what we're seeing at a given moment, because she's just gone through the entire year of the Book of Yoga, where all these systems have been purified and checked and made divine. Mind, life, body, the soul is in contact. She's in contact with the cosmic consciousness. She is the divine mother at this point. But it comes to its fruition through the encounter with death. She comes into her full force. This is that day for preparation. So yeah, the will is through and through this whole canto. But then there's also her mind. Her mind has come through nirvana, discovery of the all-negating absolute, where she learns and shows us how to completely silence the mind in Book 7, Canto 6. And from there emerges the cosmic consciousness, which is through and through in here. And then love is always the circuitry that's driving this. There's the love for Satyavan appears through and through this canto, and it becomes he a number of times. It's named and then is followed with like he and her, which is love and her, and it can also be Satyavan.
Yeah, I would love to point out there what for me is the key in this canto, or a centerpiece, is on page 14. Love came to her, hiding the shadow death. Well might he find in her his perfect shrine. And I think this is beyond Satyavan. This is the divine's love, the great love. Finds his embodiment in her. And then the whole rest, there's the he in my mind refers back to this, to the love, to the divine love. It's gorgeous.
Including the mention at the bottom of 15, love in her was wider than the universe. Yeah. The subsequent he's referring back to love.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. She comes to embody that. And he enters her there. It's the moment where she's becomes fully manifest of her true nature, which is love.
And I see that entity personified with her and Satyavan.
So I'd like to just present or offer a little different way of thinking about or reading this canto. This is actually only canto 2. It's only the second canto in the whole volume. And we could say we haven't read the rest of it yet. Sri Aurobindo wrote this to be the second canto, not the 40th or the 50th canto. So we can also read it that way, which is he's kind of giving us all these allusions. He's not necessarily, assuming that we know all of the story. If we're Indian, we know the story of Savitri, but it's just a minuscule part of the Mahabharata compared to this. And it has none of this, doesn't have this richness like this does. So we can read it without the knowledge of all these things that are going to happen later, but just read it on its own and kind of feel it, even though the mind doesn't know what all these things are. But still, there's this weight and this beauty in it that can be appreciated just for itself.
Thank you, John, Robert, for that. I want to appreciate this, just these few lines toward the end of the canto that I think tie and link together the mind, the will, and the heart, the love dimension. It's a few lines down, beginning mid-sentence, after a semicolon. A heart stood in the way of the driving wheels. Its giant workings paused in front of a mind. Its stark conventions met the flame of a soul. A magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled ineffable's timeless will. A prayer, a master act, a king idea can link man's strength to a transcendent force. That quite stood out for me, and I the will stood out, but then when I went back to it in the light of your comments, I saw the other aspects as well. So thanks.
And it unifies the transcendent, cosmic, and individual, as well as unifying mind, soul, and heart.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Where was that, Marco? I wasn't tracking.
That in my edition, page 20.
I was just reading an article that Matteo pointed out to me the other day on Savitri, and it's about the will in Savitri. And Sri Aurobindo, especially in Ashwapati's Yoga, which is the first half of the book that we'll start on with the next canto. Ashwapati's Yoga is based on his effort. It's also based on the response of the divine. It's always based on that. But it's not just putting yourself in the lap of the Divine Mother and she takes care of everything. He's alone a lot, and he's going on proceeding constantly, going past these places that are so wonderful that the rest of us would stop and hang out there for a few lifetimes, or so terrible that we wouldn't want to go into them. And he just keeps plowing on. So this article emphasized the will, and I thought that was really interesting. And then you just brought it up here too, so you're already picking up on that.
I think I just put the link in the chat box. Did anyone see that? Yeah.
I see the link there.
What does that mean?
If you click on chat, Andre, on the bottom of the screen and open that chat dialogue box, do you see a link in there?
I see the box, yeah.
Okay. When you open it, is there a link?
Well, I closed it, so yeah, there is. Do you want me to open that?
You don't need to. You've actually read the article before. It's by Matthias Corneliusen, the article titled Onward She Passed, Rejection in Savitri.
Yeah, I see. It's by Matthias Corneliusen. So will that stay on my computer if I just close it here?
If you've opened it afterwards? If you've opened it in a web browser, then it will be behind.
So I should open it now if I want to keep it.
Or you can email me later also.
Okay, I did that. We'll see what happens. Thank you.
Shall we begin again? I think let's start with Jeffrey. And Jeffrey, do you need to know where the stop is?
Yeah, I do.
The line, that hour had fallen now. So we're going to stop there and open for discussion. And then we'll go Jeffrey, John, Robert, me, Marco, Andrea.
Okay. Canto 2, The Issue. a while, withdrawn in secret fields of thought. Her mind moved in a many-imaged past that lived again and saw its end approach. Dying, it lived imperishably in her. Transient and vanishing from transient eyes, invisible, a fateful ghost of self, it bore the future in its phantom breast. Along the fleeting events' far backward trail regressed the stream of the insistent hours, and on the bank of the mysterious flood peopled with well-loved forms, now seen no more, and the subtle images of things that were, her witness spirit stood, reviewing time. All that she once had hoped and dreamed and been flew past her eagle-winged through memory's skies. As in a many-hued flaming inner dawn, her life's broad hideways and its sweet bypass lay mapped to her sun-clear recording view. From the bright country of her childhood's days and the blue mountains of her soaring youth and the paradise groves and peacock wings of love to joy clutched under the silent shadow of doom in the last turn where heaven raced with hell. 12 passionate months led in a day of fate. An absolute supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes when he draws near to God. An hour arrives when fail all nature's means, forced out from the protecting ignorance and flung back on his naked primal need, he at length must cast from him his surface soul and be the ungarbed entity within. That hour had fallen now on Savitri.
So there is this life review here, going back to her childhood and then the turn into the present moment and the direct reference of 12 passionate months, the year that she's just been through, the unimaginable foreknowledge of the death of her soulmate. I love Sri Aurobindo saying, an absolute supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes. I love that sometimes in there. It's like it doesn't, it's not always, but sometimes when man draws near to God.
As always, the wonderful rhythms in these texts, in these words. I spent the weekend, so I do every year an exercise called the 3-day novel contest, where you write a novel in 3 days. And I just completed a novel. But it deals with the St. Lawrence River and issues of gender fluidity. And I wrote poetry into the novel, but I think my poetry had some of Aurobindo's wings on it. At least I hope so. Certainly the rhythms were there.
I'd be curious to hear others' thoughts on the naked primal need that man is sometimes flung back upon when forced out of the protecting ignorance down towards the bottom of the page. And the ungarbed entity within. I'm curious about the connection between that need and the goddess. To what, how does she share that need? Is that reflected? Is that purely man's or humanity's need?
So in my understanding, our naked primal need is for that, is to experience that union, the ultimate union, you know, and the awareness in our soul. So that after, when we come through, just like a description, the absolute supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes, when we talk about the night of the soul that we go through, that is there because we have this desperate need for this oneness. And it only gets revealed when at length we are able to cast from our surface soul the ungarbed, and be the ungarbed entity within, which is our true self. We all long to be our true self. But that is the primal naked need. That's my understanding of this.
To diverge a little bit, I really sense that T.S. Eliot entered into the dark night of the soul in some culmination form when he wrote the four quartets, but it doesn't seem like he, if anyone's familiar with the four quartets, it doesn't seem like he emerged. He brings in Krishna and Arjuna, and there's an aspiration of reaching to emerge, but he seems to have been stuck there, probably poetically and probably personally also.
Not to diverge too much further, but I think I would agree, and the overall feeling I get from the quartets is of a stasis, of an end. And I think I think he was self-aware in that sense. I think Eliot was aware of that, but didn't have, the dawn had not, there was no dawn. here there is some dawn.
And when I say he was reaching toward it, it was like the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, is Krishna saying, don't fare well, but fare forward. But it just never emerges, right? It goes into even murkier brown rivers, and not knowing much about gods, but thinking that the river is a strong brown god, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of, I think about Jeffrey coming and the cross-referencing that's going on with the other group. So that's why that's coming up, John Robert and Andrea, the sister group to this group is kind of trying to draw these connections, or looking to draw connections between this work and those. I don't know, is Eliot part of it?
He's sort of, he came into the discussion, let's say. He's not necessarily directly a part of it, but I find, you may be right about Eliot, that he's kind of stuck, but he is struggling with the issues of, in that poem, with the issue of spiritual enlightenment and our incarnation in the world. He may not go somewhere with it, but he's right bang in the middle of that struggle, which is one of the reasons why I love those texts so much. I'm thinking of this, the opening lines for this canto. So, a while withdrawn in secret fields of thought, her mind moved in a many-imaged past that lived again and saw its end approach. Dying, it lived imperishably in her. That could paraphrase the four quartets. It's a kind of encapsulation of what's going on in Eliot's poem, I think.
And I know that the four quartets were on Sri Aurobindo's shelf in 1934. He is well aware of T.S. Eliot, as well as Whitman and Wordsworth, etc.
I love, Marco, how you were talking about the dawn, that the dawn hadn't arrived. And it's like Savitri is the dawn. She's bringing this light to humanity. And the theme of the dawn is all over the place in, you know, Out of Window, Oroville, City of Dawn. So that was, I really enjoyed you bringing that, naming that.
It comes via, to me, via Life Divine and the opening of Life Divine, the endless succession of dawns, which we began the Life Divine reading with. And Matteo chanted that for us a few times, I think. Thank you. I thought I had a thought, but I don't think. I did want to provide context, because on the alternating weeks, so John, Robert, and Andrea, or anyone else viewing this knows, we are reading a kind of braided selection of three English poets, excuse me, two English and one American, John Milton's Paradise Lost, William Blake, and Whitman. And I'm not sure exactly how those three particularly came into the mix. I think Jeffrey was part of that discussion. But the idea was to look into some of the poets that Aurobindo would have been reading or would have been in a certain way drawing on and in some dialogue with, presumably anyway, and to look for those kinds of connections. So that's what's going on there on these alternating weeks. And we're starting to have some like meta dialogue between the groups because we're finding common themes and patterns. And so that has been one of the interesting, I think, dimensions or aspects of this experiment.
As in a mini flaming inner dawn. That's all I wanted to say.
I just wanted to say thank you to Marco for filling us in on what's going on. Marco and Jeffrey for filling us in on what's going on alternate weeks.
Shall we continue?
I could point out one other thing about this page here that's a frequent strategy that Sri Aurobindo uses in Savitri. So up until the line, an absolute darkness, supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes, up until that, he was in the narrative part of the canto, and then he steps out of that strictly narrative and he reflects on it. And so that'll happen over and over again, where he'll be in the narrative part of the epic, and at a point, often without any paragraph break or any other noticeable marker, he'll begin to reflect on the meaning of or the significance, rather than continuing to describe the narrative.
Thank you, John Robert. Yeah, let's find more of those cues where he toggles, because there are a lot. He does it in a lot of different ways. Sentences, lines starting with as if or as when. There's a lot of this.
Who's our next reader?
John Roberts.
Would it be okay to get going with that?
I'm good.
A point she had reached where life must be in vain, or in her unborn element awake, her will must cancel her body's destiny. For only the unborn spirit's timeless power can lift the yoke imposed by birth in time. Only the self that builds this figure of self can raise the fixed, interminable line that joins these changing names, these numberless lives, these new oblivious personalities, and keeps still lurking in our conscious acts the trail of old forgotten thoughts and deeds. Disown the legacy of our buried selves, the burdensome heirship to our vanished forms accepted blindly by the body and soul. An episode in an unremembered tale, its beginning lost, its motive and plot concealed. A once living story has prepared and made our present fate, child of past energies. The fixity of the cosmic sequences, fastened with hidden, inevitable links she must disrupt, dislodge by her soul's force her past, a block on the immortal's road, make a raised ground and shape anew her fate. A colloquy of the original gods meeting upon the borders of the unknown. Her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous, dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause, against the universe weigh its single self. On the bare peak where self is alone with naught, and life has no sense and love no place to stand, she must plead her case upon extinction's verge. In the world's death cave, uphold life's helpless claim and vindicate her right to be and love.
So is this discussion time? All of that is commentary, right? In the sense that you were talking about, John Robert.
Well, he starts this page by saying that hour had fallen now on Savitri. So he's in the narrative arc again here.
Okay.
At this point, at a point she had reached where life must be in vain. So he's talking about her specific life here.
Okay.
But he's also weaving into that this commentary that he has about the dark night and how there are these occasions where a person has to throw out everything and face the infinite. And that's what she's doing here. Or that's what he's talking about her doing.
So I noticed reading this, I remember when we were reading The Life Divine, Matthew, that used to say, oh, this is all in Savitri. And I'm now beginning to get it as we go forward. I can see all of the complexity of the thought that's presented in The Life Divine sort of threaded in through these lines in ways that I think are perhaps easier to understand than The Life Divine in some ways, even though it's not laid out quite as structurally, but it's much more visceral in the way of picking it up.
Right. It's like Savitri is not a mental exercise, like The Life Divine might be. I would just like to, it just struck me here, in the world's death cave, uphold life's helpless claim and vindicate her right to be and love. And that is actually then what happens on the very last page of Canto 12, of Book 12. It's the ending of the whole book, is that she realizes that. I was pleased to just see it right here. That last page, awakened to the meaning of my heart, that to feel love and oneness is to live. And this, the magic of our golden change, is all the truth I know or seek, O sage. So here it is.
Spoiler. That's really beautiful.
Spoiling everything.
I found that line, against the universe, weigh its single self, all leading right into that vindication, to be really striking. And I'm noticing that, and perhaps I need some help with this, that the gender fluidity here is sometimes confusing to me, a little bit confusing, because at times Aurobindo is talking about man or humanity, and at times about Savitri as a divine being, a goddess or a mother goddess, and at times as an individual, as a single self with the lowercase s, which then has an uppercase s self as its true being, and yet is come face to face with this almost absolute opposition, the whole universe, the cosmic, you know, the natural law, and has to me, that the whole, it seems that the whole drama is of that helpless claim of life in the face of this cosmic darkness and time itself. So I say it's a little confusing because I don't know, I feel a lot of those things too, right? I think perhaps we all do, that sense of the small s self and the helplessness that is part of being a small s self. But then that vindication, I guess, is really like that sense that it doesn't matter how small one may appear to be. Something like that seems to be what is going on here. And anyway, I don't have anything illuminating to add. I'm more sharing a bit of that confusion that I have still. But I also appreciate Andrea's almost just connecting this point to that resolution in a way. It's like a preview of that, because I can intuit, I think, what that means, but I think I have not. I think we have to go through, perhaps through the whole exercise, as it were, of the poem.
I love that idea, Marco, where you use the term gender, but you're not referring to masculine, feminine difference, but self and larger self. Because of course the term gender is rooted in the notion of people as opposed to sex or differences between male and female. So you can apply the term gender to this other framework, I think. You can defend doing so anyway. And I think it's very interesting to do that here. That he's, because he is talking about gender in the masculine feminine sense as well, but he's also talking about gender in the smaller S self and the larger S self.
There's a connection with Jung too. Jung, archetypal psychology and the anima and the animus. I don't know how much that would help or how much that is significant here, but that comes to mind.
Has anyone read Kafka on the Shore by Murakami? No.
I have.
Yeah. So you know that the main character, not the main character, not Kafka, but the one who is the keeper of the bookstore is a gender bender. And there's some interesting dialogues that he, she has about gender being a grammatical term and sex is for humans or something like that. It's much more eloquent than I just said, but similar. And I like using these terms, playing with these terms, making them interchangeable and using capital S, lowercase s. It's great. The Upanishads even do things that are almost counter. I mean, I can't remember which. The Prashna Upanishad is talking about life and vital as he entering into matter as she and things like that. It's beautiful to kind of play with these things. I think it helps, playing with these things, I think helps illuminate them and helps resolve the dualities, right? We're in a seemingly dualistic world. When we start playing with dualities, it helps them illumine and resolve, which is the whole kind of the whole function of some of the early Upanishads is to shed light on these, is to resolve the dualities, to illuminate.
I also wonder about the role, maybe the unspoken role of the mother in this text, and in what sense is the relationship between Sri Aurobindo and the mother reflected in or included in the text? Because they've almost formed a sort of mind between them, as I understand it.
A dual avatar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they describe themselves as one consciousness. And I think the entire book reflects Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Every time he describes Savitri, I see the mother. It's like he had the visceral, literal, material experience of this embodiment in her. Whenever he describes her gracious nature, how she walks, the lilt of her voice, everything, it's like that was his experience of her. I am positive. Yeah.
Thank you.
There's some well-documented experiences of the mother receiving pages of Savitri and as he was writing them and reading them and being like, saying something like, and I'm paraphrasing, but saying something like, wow, this is everything that I was experiencing last night, and he was writing it down. And the two of them as a dual power were completely surrendered to each other's consciousness. They said over and over again that there was no difference between their consciousness, and they acted as an Ishwara Shakti, her saying, without him, what is the quote, Andrea? Without, go ahead. Yeah. Without him, I exist not. Without
him,
me.
Without me, without him, I do not exist. Without me, he is unmanifest. Without him, I do not exist. Without me, he is unmanifest. She exists because of him. He's manifested because of her. This is the Divine Mother, is the embodiment, is the entire universe, material embodiment of the divine, of the absolute. That's mythology or whatever you would call that behind that, my understanding.
And I think understanding that, actually, those that chapter in the Life Divine is something like Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, something like that. The conversations that he's having in the life, in that chapter of the Life Divine about Ishwara Shakti, like, I think that that's what Andrea just quoted. It's a real key to kind of getting the difference between the Prakriti Purusha connection, the Ishwara Shakti connection, and the Brahma Maya, or Brahma Atman Maya connection.
So thank you. So I'm looking at this sequence, the fixity of the cosmic sequences fastened with hidden inevitable links. She must disrupt, dislodge by her soul's force, her past, a block on the immortal's road, make a raised ground and shape anew her fate. So when I read that, I'm cognizant of this idea of involution that Aurobindo has, because the block on the immortal's road, which we all recognize, is a block that was put in place presumably during the involution, and now we're looking at the evolution stage. And so, unlike texts that would talk about a block as being some sort of absolute, for Aurobindo, the blocks are necessary and built in through the process in order to get to this other state, right? So I love that passage because it has implicitly those ideas in it, right? That's what I mean about the Life Divine is embedded inside this text, right? So.
All part of the adventure of consciousness and joy, which we had, which you mentioned in the first canto.
Let me just ask about our time. I have to transition to something beginning in the next hour. So, and we've been a little bit ambiguous as to how the window that we have, is it 90 minutes?
90 to 100.
Oh. So, okay, so it's open.
Uh-huh, yeah, it's open to kind of close at the right time. I have something at the top of the next hour also, so I'll have to transition in about 8 minutes.
Would we have time to just make the second passage reading through?
No, I don't think we could even do that. Discussion. I don't think, not in 8 minutes. We could, yeah. What do we want to do though with the time that we have left? And just because I need to leave doesn't mean that anyone else needs to leave.
I'd actually rather not read the next page too, because I think reading the page and then the discussion that comes after them, it's nice to have them going together. So, but
maybe
it can be viewed in a whole lot of different ways. So it's just one way.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like we should call it a day. And then pick this up next time.
That sounds good. Maybe even at the top or something, start at the beginning and then read through page 13 and start the discussion from there. Mm-hmm. So, and then I was also going to recommend the closing with an entire pass through after we're done with the discussion, then have another move through before we go on to the next canto. So that might dovetail nicely with our next section.
With our next session.
I'm always for more reading. Aloud.
You're for more reading aloud. You like to read out.
I like to read aloud.
Yeah. I'm with you, Jeffrey. Does everyone want to end with a 3-minute meditation?
I would love to. And just to comment too on the readings approach that we're taking, I think there's a method to the madness, and it's almost like multiple passes, or it's some sort of cooking that we're doing. There's like, we have to break things down, then we have to combine them, recombine them, and I think it's sort of a process of things becoming more flavorful and richer. And more digestible as well, because, you know, we could put things in conceptual philosophical terms and think we got them, but I think go through the adventure is what grounds it in our body minds. So I appreciate the approach and the care and thoughtfulness that and intentionality that we're bringing to it. That's all I want to say. Thank you, friends. What a lovely session. Another lovely session.
Thank you. It's very special to be with you all.
Jeffrey, thank you for not being shy about joining a half hour, an hour, whatever. It's nice.
I was looking forward to it all day, and then I got the times mixed up because of the cafe, I guess. I thought it was
goodness.
Two instead of one, but two.
I'm planning to be with you all next week. Milton.
Yeah, and that's a different time. That's quite
7 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Panama. Perfect.
All right.
Good to see everybody.
Good to see you all. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.